And one of the fun things, I'm afflicted with a number of problems, and one of them is that I love to read. It was the first escape that I ever had, and I love history. And I have a friend up in Santa Barbara who's a bookbinder, and he's a Franciscan monk, and I needed a Bible. And he bound this Bible that was from 1905, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous piece. And in it was this temperance pledge. And so before Alcoholics Anonymous, guys like me, what we were offered was something like this. We hereby solemnly promise God helping us to abstain from all distilled, fermented, and malt liquor, including wine and beer, bummer, to employ all proper means to discourage the use of and traffic in the same. What an order. I can't go through with it. This afternoon, what I'd like to talk about is the Oxford Group, who the people were and what it is that they believed in. Because I believe that in knowing where we come from, we get a better understanding of who we are. And so this is kind of a story about who it is that we are. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to share with you a lot of different things that I've been fortunate enough to read over the years. And one of the things that I need to share with you is about my friend Dick Burns. And Dick Burns has done a lot of marvelous books on AA history. And the most important thing is that he's a person who has done a great service to the fellowship in his archival and almost megalomaniacal pursuit of what exactly happened. I mean, this is a man who's willing to sit for days and days at a time and go through every page of Sam Shoemaker's journal to find out where it was that Sam said that Bill Wilson came in the office. Remarkable. And anyway, so one of the things I'd like to recommend to you is a couple of his titles. And the one that today that I found very, very helpful over the years was A New Light on Alcoholism, Sam Shoemaker and Alcoholics Anonymous. The Oxford Group was a semi-religious but informal movement founded by Frank Buckman in 1921 while he was an undergraduate doing some undergraduate work at Oxford University. The name was first applied to the group in South Africa. There were a group of them from England, from Oxford, that were down doing some missionary work, some conversion work with people, and a guy from a newspaper looked at the train car that they were on, and there was a little sticker that was put on there to identify their car, and it said the Oxford Group. So he took that, and it was short and it was easy, and it described who this group of people were, so it kind of stuck. But they actually never had any affiliation with Oxford University of any kind whatsoever. Can you hear me okay in the back, Dottie? Okay. The professed purpose of the Oxford Group was to solve personal, national, and international problems by bringing men and women everywhere back to the basic principles of Christian faith while enhancing all of their primary loyalty. This definition comes from an old encyclopedia called the Lincoln Library. And in the Lincoln Library, published in 1955, it's very interesting. There's three paragraphs on the Oxford Group, and there's one paragraph on Alcoholics Anonymous. It goes on to say that without organization, membership, subscription, or definite creed, the movement rapidly obtained adherence in nearly all countries of the world. This isn't just a strange little band of folks in England and in New York and Ohio. Particularly in the middle and upper classes, and was accorded recognition by leading figures in many governments. Adopting the name Moral Rearmament in 1938, the leaders of the movement sought by the spread of its principles to stem the tide of hostility. These men and women felt that it was their mission to try and stop the evolution that became the Second World War. Now, I'd like to read you the Oxford Group preamble. This is from a book called What is the Oxford Group? And it's available from Hazelden Press. You cannot belong to the Oxford Group. It has no membership list, subscription, badge rules, or definite location. It is a name for a group of people who, from every rank, profession, and trade, in many countries, have surrendered their lives to God and are endeavoring to lead a spiritual quality of life under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. The Oxford Group is not a religion. It has no hierarchy, no temples, no endowments. Its workers have no salaries, no plans but God's plan. Every country is their country, every man their brother. Sound a little familiar? Every historian has their conceit. And what I want to share with you is that I'm not here to tell you that something is right or that something is wrong. All that I want to do today is try and expose you to the language and thoughts that our founders synthesized and used in order to found Alcoholics Anonymous. The leader of the Oxford Group was a gentleman by the name of Frank Buckman. This guy was nominated twice, once before the Second World War for trying to stop it, and once after the Second World War for the work in trying to get nations, not individuals, to reconcile with each other. He was decorated by the governments of France, Germany, Greece, Japan, and the Philippines for his work after. He founded the Oxford Group. In 1938, they changed the name officially into Moral Rearmament. And it's really interesting that this group, and I'll touch on this later, was equally vilified by hawks and doves, labor and management, liberals and conservatives, fascists and communists all over the world. Everybody disliked this guy that had any agenda. Frank, for the purpose of this story, in 1907, Frank has been an ordained Lutheran minister for about 5 years. He's been involved in church work in Pennsylvania. He ran a boys' home. And he went, he got involved with this boys' home, and he grew it so much. There were so many folks that were coming to it, so many young men. They were given a place to eat, a place to take a shower. They were given Bible instructions. They had fellowship meetings. And they were given a place to stay, and they were fed. And the thing got so, the response to it was so great there in the slums of Philadelphia that the board that he was working for got upset because there was all this money going out. And they decided that what they were going to do was that the best thing they could do to save money was to cut the rations that the boys were eating. And Frank got upset with that, and he quit. And he decided, well, he's going to go off, and he's going to spend a year in Europe preaching and studying and meeting with other people. And while he was in, and he kept trying to do personal work, trying to convert individuals. And what happened is he wasn't having any success. And one day he's in Keswick, England, and he's listening to the Salvation Army woman talk about the cross of Jesus, and he has this image of a big I, the letter I. And he came to believe that he saw in that moment what his problem was. It was himself, his ego. And that what he had to do was he had to get right with God and himself if he was ever going to be any use, if he was ever going to be able to preach effectively. So what he did was, is he went home that night, and to the six members of this board, he wrote them letters of amends. And he said, I've harbored ill will for you. Please forgive me. And the most amazing thing happened the next day. He was walking and talking with a kid, and the kid asked him about this inner light that he had. And he had his first experience of sharing with someone in over a year. And this kid made a decision for Christ. And so what happened is that Buckman believed to the very core of his being that what was most important was that that a person had to get clean first in order to have any kind of a spiritual life. From 1907 on, he started to go out to different countries preaching this message, and the message generally he was preaching was to people who were involved in missionary work. And the last slide that we showed was of him in 1915 meeting with the Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi said that Buckman's work as in the Oxford Group and later in moral rearmament was the most important movement to come out of the West. This is a man who, between 1912 and 1961, when he died, had contact with just about every major political figure in the West, some in a few in Eastern Europe, in Africa, and in South America, trying to talk about working a set of spiritual principles. Later on, what happened is that he went back to, Frank went back to Pennsylvania, and he became the head of the Young Men's Christian Association at Penn State University. And there he was in charge with helping with the moral life of the students there. And in 1922 in Penn State University, there was a lot of drinking going on. A lot of drinking going on. And at the time, only 15% of the young eligible men were members of the Young Men's Christian Association. And so he was trying to figure out what he could do. And Frank came to believe that the way to confront any group was you find the most outrageous sinners, and those are the people that you approach. And at Penn State University, there was a gentleman, and his name was Bill Pickle. And Bill Pickle was the son of a bootlegger and was a bootlegger. And he was a tough, mean, nasty, irate guy. And he said, when Buckman started doing personal work at the university, that he'd just as soon stick a knife in him as to breathe the same air that he breathed. And one day, Frank's walking along with a guy that he's trying to pass the message on to, and they see Pickle. And he knows that if he doesn't approach Pickle, that he's going to lose this guy. And he's scared to death. And he walks up and he approaches his and he says, "Bill," Pickle turned around to him and he said, "We've been praying for you." And the story is that all the fight went out of the man's face. And over the next 3 weeks, he went around to some other meetings that Frank was going to. And Bill made a decision for Christ, and he quit drinking, and he quit bootlegging. And nobody could believe it there at Penn State University. The connection went to the other side. It was horrible. And Bill Pickle never took another drink in his life. And I believe that this is where the slang term being pickled comes from. It's actually from him, because over the next 40 years, here and there, he would actually go out with Oxford Group teams and testify to what happened in his life. And what happened with Bill is that Bill couldn't read or write, and he sat down and with Frank, and he shared the things that troubled him the most. And for Bill, it was the way that he treated his wife and his family. And he wrote, Frank wrote these letters to the children and to his wife, and the guy's life just changed. When we talk about Buckman, we're talking about a Lutheran minister. So we're going to talk a lot of Christian stuff. That's all this is, you know. And what we are is we're the outgrowth of this group that believed that there was absolutely no problem, no human problem that could not be addressed by spiritual means. And what we've been able to do is take their vision and expand it a little bit. And we have a movement now that encompasses, what, maybe 500 different anonymous fellowships all over the world. the same solution of applying spiritual principles to personal problems. But what Buckman saw was that the big thing that got in between people and God was sin. And what Buckman defined sin as was anything that got between you and God, or that got between you and your fellow man. And in this wonderful book, the Oxford Group authors had great titles. And this is for sinners only. I'm qualified to read it. And in it, this is, you know, we sit around and we think, how can these drunks have put up with all this Jesus stuff? Well, you know, we have to remember what the country was like in those days and who these people were and how they were raised. But also that this was a dynamic message that people hadn't heard before. Buckman described sin was anything contrary to the will of God, and that he said that there was no complete catalog of sins for everybody, since what was sin to one might not always be sin to another. Sin might be drunkenness or pride, murder or dishonesty, selfishness or refusal to love God or one's neighbor, coveting another man's wife or loving the husband of another woman. It might be overeating or vain boasting or overcalling your partner at bridge. It might be graft or greed, pugnacity or fear, waste or meanness, aversion or perversion. Such sins and all others were included in the one major sin of independence toward God, who should be first, last, and at all times sought as taught in the Ten Commandments in the New Testament. Now, Frank, actually, people would say to him, you know, well, is this a sin? Or what do you think about this? And what Frank would say is, he said, you should do anything that God lets you do. Remarkable. Now, what Frank would do is that he would work with people, and they called them personal interviews. And these people would go through a set of spiritual exercises. And what I'd like to do is share with you the steps of the Oxford Group. The Oxford Group had four steps that they believed that anyone who applied them to their lives would have the ability to have a spiritual regeneration. The first one was the sharing of our sins and temptations with another Christian life given to God, and to use sharing as witness to help others still unchanged to recognize and acknowledge their sins. So they're doing steps 4 and 5 first to clear you up so you can do what we call step 3. They said surrender of our life, past, present, and future, into God's keeping and direction. Their third step, that thing which would finally clear us up so we were able to have a spiritual experience, was restitution to all that we have harmed, directly or indirectly. And finally, the fruit of that work is their fourth step, listening to, accepting, and relying on God's guidance and carrying it out in everything that we say, great or small. Men and women started to do these things, and they started to change. One of the things they used to call the Oxford Group was the life changers, or the soul surgeons. And they'd actually say stuff like that, the life changers are coming to town. And what would happen is that Buckman would get together a group of people, normally people that wouldn't mix. There'd be a society housewife and maybe a star athlete. There'd be a German count and maybe a British noblewoman, a guy like Bill Pickle, a normal housewife. And they would send a team, and they called it, the reason that Buckman said that he liked to work in teams is because that's what Jesus used. Was he had a team. And what these teams would do is they would go into a town and they would carry the message. They would get up and they would tell their stories, what they used to be like, what happened as a result of working their steps, and then what their lives were like now. And one of the great things for us is that in 1931, a guy by the name of Bud Firestone met a man by the name of Samuel Shoemaker at an Episcopal Bishops' Conference in Denver. And on a train line out of that, Bud worked those steps. And Bud, who was a horrible alcoholic, obsession to drink was removed at that moment that he did his sharing, his fourth and fifth step, his first step with Shoemaker. And from that, I mean, his family was amazed, and the family doctor even called it a medical miracle. The family was so grateful that what they did is that they contacted, after watching the guy for a while and seeing that he actually had changed, they actually invited the group to come. And so a team came to the town of Akron, where the Firestone family was, and Frank Buckman and a group brought their message of working these steps to that western town. And what happened is the message was heard by some men and women. And the people that were sitting in the audience were T. Henry and Clarice Williams, Henrietta Seiberling, Bob and Ann Smith, the Reverend Walter Tunk, James Newton, Roland Hazard, all these folks, well, not all of them that are here, but this is a list of the major players. And after the talk today, if you want, we've got some, we've got a list of these people with little bios and some notes about what it is that we're talking about today. So if you enjoy them, we'd be happy to make them available to you. So what would happen is the team would come in. And one of my favorite stories about the Oxford Group is that in 1933, an Oxford Group team went through Canada. Okay, this is the height of the Depression. There are 60 people. They never had more than a week's expenses. Frank never collected money. He never asked for it. It was people like Firestone saying, you know, I'd like you to come. Here's some money. We'll rent the hotel. It was the voluntary contributions of people who were asked at meetings. They never passed the hat. And for 8 months, this group of people went back and forth across Canada carrying this message. It started out, when it started, there were like 3,000 people at their first meeting in Ottawa. By the time they got to Vancouver, 30,000 people are showing up to listen to these people. You know, in Akron, when Buckman and the gang came, there were 1,600 people that showed up for those meetings, which is just stunning. Anyway, the other thing that I'd like to tell you about Buckman is the kind of guy that he was. He believed that the people that were closest to the flame, the people who had been converted the earliest, were the ones that had the best message. You know, give me a man that's 30 days sober. Does anybody give a better pitch than the guy who's got, or gal who's got their first year birthday? You know, we really ought to record it so we can give it back to him later on down the line. But anyway, here's a description of Frank. Sir Arnold Lund, the author and inventor of the slalom and downhill races and skiing, used often to criticize Buckman in his books. Later on, he went to the Moral Rearmament Center in Switzerland to study Buckman and his work at first hand. Thereafter, he went there most years over a 10-year period, partly because he enjoyed the company, yet still Buckman puzzled him. Now, he's talking about Frank, right? He has no charisma, I can see. He isn't good-looking. He's no orator, he has never written a book, and he seldom even leads a meeting. Yet statesmen and great intellects come from all over the world to consult him, and a lot of intelligent people have stuck with him full-time without salary for years when they could have been making careers for themselves. Why? Life-changing. Soul surgery. A a mission, a pleasure beyond description. When we talk about Buxman, one of the things that's really important to do is to understand that this guy, at one time, he's on a bicycle. He's in England, and he's riding his bike at night, and he gets struck with a very, very loud voice, and it says, you will help to remake the world. The guy was 45 years old at the time. And when we look at what it is that he did with his life, you have to understand that that's what he was doing. Every decision he made, everything that he tried to do was in pursuit of that vision of remaking the world. What it was that the Oxford Group taught and studied isn't anything brand new. They had the five C's, which I'll talk about in a minute, the four absolutes. They recommended reading 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and they absolutely insisted on quiet time. Absolutely. And in fact, when you take a look at our literature, and what it is that the people that taught, what was important to early AA members, it wasn't the meetings. It was getting direction from God on how to approach your day. It was the quiet time and the sharing of their stories with other people. The four absolutes were first came up by an evangelist by the name of Robert Speer. And he believed that if you took the New Testament and all the teachings of Jesus, but most specifically the Sermon on the Mount, that there were four absolutes, and the Oxford Group really refers to it most of their literature as standards after they first talk about these. That if you have any question in your life, any conduct, any dilemma at all you have to do is it loving or not? Is it honest or not? Is it pure or not? Is it selfish or is it unselfish? And those were the four absolutes. And one of the things about Corinthians that, which is the great thing that we hear at weddings when we go to weddings and sometimes at funerals and the descriptions Paul has of love, the Oxford Group believed that if you really wanted to change, that what you would do is that you take that passage from the Bible, and that if you read it every day for 30 days, that you would never be the same again. And one of the great 12-step stories is they run into Dr. Bob, and there's this woman, and she's in the DTs. What should we do with her? And he says, get Henry Drummond's book, which is The Greatest Thing in the World, which is still available in any Christian bookstore. Get The Greatest Thing in the World, give it to her, and have her read it every day for 30 days, and she'll never be the same again. Now, during the late teens, Buxman's going back and forth from the United States to England, and he's on a cruise liner, and he's talking with people at the table, and one of the things that happens is he's talking with this woman, and the woman says to him, you know, she's interested in this thing about being a life changer, about having something in her life that's based something on something aside from herself. And she says, you've got to, if you're going to teach me this, you've got to break it down. You've got to make it really simple for somebody like me. And so Buxman said, okay, and the next morning in his quiet time, what he came up with was what he called the five C's. And the first, and I don't know, how many of you have read or do read the 24-hour day book? I don't know if you've seen the last 5 days. Remarkably, it's been about the five C's. The 24-hour day book is actually a reworking by an Oxford Group member, Richard Walker, of a classic Oxford Group book called God Calling. And like almost like much of the Oxford Group material, it was written anonymously. A.J. Russell is the person who edited it. Wonderful story about this book is that these two women sponsors found that they didn't like each other, these two English women, so they recommended that they spend their quiet time together. Hard-hearted sponsors, it's a long lineage. And so they started to, and what happened is that when you would spend your quiet time, one of the things they recommended was that, because the old Chinese proverb that one thing that's written is more powerful than the strongest memory, they would always recommend, so that you'd remember what God told you while you're sitting there, is that you'd write down what it is that you heard or what you felt. And so these gals started writing, and what came out was not something that either of them were familiar with at all. And it was almost like an automatic writing, and they didn't know what to do with it. And A.J. Russell was an Oxford Group member who was the editor of the London Daily Mail's religion section. And so they sent him off to him, and he took a look at it, and he couldn't believe what it was. And so what they did is that they published it, and they say that it's by two listeners. So if you take your 24-hour-a-day book, and you go down to a library and you pick up God Calling by A.J. Russell, what you'll find is the meditation, the prayer for each day, the meditation for each day actually comes from this. It's reworded a little bit for people that have a drinking problem. And when I go through the five C's, I'm also going to refer a little bit to it in that fashion. The first C was confidence. That there must be a connection and identification at depth for a person to be changed. In other words, that I've got to believe who you are. I've got to believe that what it is that you're telling me is authentic. I have to be able to have confidence that you've actually had the change that you've had. And that's what I got when I went to my first AA meeting. I heard people speak about their drinking stories. And what these Oxford Group members would is they'd tell their stories. The second thing was confession. Second C's confession. And Buckman's lines on confession were, when somebody shared their story, the first thing was, and I think you may have heard this from a few sponsors along the line, never betray an appearance of shocked surprise. If you're really trying to help somebody through a fifth step, be ready to convince your own shortcomings honestly and bluntly. And finally, keep every confidence absolutely sacred. The third C is conviction. And what the Oxford Group people would say is that the person that you're working with has to be convicted of the power of sin, about sin's binding power, sin's blinding power, and sin's deadly power. And I don't know about you, but when I came into my first few meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I learned was alcohol's binding power, and alcohol's blinding power, and its deadly power. The fourth is conversion. And what Buckman described conversion as was it's a transaction between a person, soul, and God. That's what conversion is, when that transaction happens. They used to always say that God outside of us is a theory. God inside of us is a fact. And they believed that no one could go through these set of steps, work through these five C's, and not have an experience of God. They viewed this stuff as absolutely practical. There wasn't anything, you know, starry-eyed or that this was cold, hard fact. One of the great conversion experiences was in William James, this variety of sort of religious experience. And the great conversion story that's in there is about a guy by the name of S.H. Hadley, who was a horrible alcoholic and had a really, really bad time. And this is, and you wonder, well, what was it in that book that got Bill's attention? And the way that it's described is, when the invitation came, I knelt down with a crowd of drunkards. I halted but a moment, and then with a breaking heart, I said, "Dear Jesus, can you help me?" Never with a mortal tongue can I describe that moment. I felt the glorious brightness of the noonday sun shine into my heart. I felt a free man. From that moment till now, I have never wanted a drink of whiskey. I've never seen enough money to make me want to take one. I promised God that night, if he would take away the appetite for strong drink, I would work for him all my life. He did his part, and I'm trying to do mine. And then the fifth of the C's was what they called conservation. Continuous. And what that meant is that you wanted, as soon as possible, to have the experience be vital, to get somebody out working with others. Following conversion, the new convert must be set to work to win others. He should understand from the first that his prayer and Bible study will ultimately become burdensome if he regards them only as fundamentally and inevitably the means of his own spiritual development and not the means of successfully serving others. What would I do without my fabulous wife, Adele, who did all this magnificent work for us? And God bless her. The next personality that I'd like to share with you is Sam Shoemaker. Could you give me some water? Oh, thank you so much. Sam Shoemaker was the rector at Calvary Chapel. Frank was in China as a missionary in 1918 when Buckman and H.A. Walter came to China to work with missionaries about this vital personal work. And what happened is he hated Buckman from the beginning. Who was this guy? Who is this guy running around telling people how they ought to do stuff? So Buckman comes into town, and Shoemaker was a marvelous guy. He had an amazing personality. In fact, this is again from Sinners Only. This is A.G. Russell's description of Sam Shoemaker, the antithesis of Buckman. Whenever I looked at him squarely, my gaze was irresistibly drawn straight to those magnetic eyes of his, those eyes that were always bright and twinkling merrily, one or the other ever closing and anon in that impish wink one comes to love and respect. Get near to Sam, and you at once feel his magnetic personality. His happy faith and contentedness so permeate the atmosphere that you feel it unnecessary for Hoover to declare the Depression officially at end. This is a Southern boy who was used to getting his way. And he's in China, and it ain't going his way. And this guy, the life changer, is coming into town, and he knows that. Sam knows that if he gets this one guy, that guy, if he can change him, that everybody else will line up, that he can really have some success. So this big gun comes in, he says, "Well, why don't you go work on this guy?" And Buckman looks at him and says, "What's preventing you from doing it?" And Sam got a little upset, and he went home that night, and he was just furious. But he saw the truth in it. He saw that he had never completely given himself to God. And so that night, in 1918, he gave himself, the next morning he got together with Buckman, and he shared with him all of his sins and all the things that he had done that he felt was keeping him from being of maximum service to God and his fellows. And the most interesting thing happened. Sam took a walk with the man, and the man decided that he'd like to become a Christian. And from that time on, what happened is that Sam believed that working with Buckman would be, doing that kind of work would be more rewarding than anything that he could do. So they went out. And for the next 7 years, they went all over the world together. To South Africa, they came to the United States, they went to South America, always doing this, what they called personal work. In 1925, Sam was an Episcopalian minister, an ordained Episcopalian minister, and he was called to Calvary Church in New York. And so he left and went and established himself as the rector there, and his church became the center, the clearinghouse for Oxford Group information throughout the United States. And one of the things that Sam did is that he wrote about 15 or 20 books on this personal work. And one of the fun things that's happened of late is that because most of these books are out of print, is Bill Pittman and Dick Burns got together, and we've got another Courage to Change book, but this particular one is a compendium of quotes from a lot of Shoemaker's sermons and books, and it's of great fun. Sam was looking for a vehicle to bring a vibrancy to this church he just came to, and there was a property that was down in the Bowery, and he decided that that this might be a place that they might be able to start a mission for drunkards and indigent men. And God sent a man by the name of Harry Hadley, who is S.H. Hadley's son, who 3 days after his father's death had a conversion experience. And Harry Hadley became the director of the Calvary Mission. The other thing about Shoemaker is that he was known by everybody as somebody, because of his personality, that had the ability to make people comfortable. He was able to express his own spiritual problems well enough that other people would respond in kind and want to share. And so he was known as someone who was very good at bringing people to Christ. And the people that he worked with were Roland Hazard, Shep Cornell, Sebra Graves, Ebbie Thatcher, and Bill Wilson. He was the man who taught spiritual principles to these people, principles that we have received, you know, in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The picture of Sam, Sam also was, he assembled a group called the Businessmen's Team. And what he wanted to do was get guys from Wall Street, major industrialists, because, you know, as you all know from any contact with New Yorkers, they believe that they are the center of the universe. And he figured that what would be best is to get a group of these people, and they would actually go out, a team of people would go out and talk about spiritual principles in business. And these are the members of the Businessmen's Team. The people that are here, Roland Hazard, Russell Firestone, Shep Cornell, B.C. Kitchen, and were actually sober, not drinking, through the Oxford Group, and active members at Calvary Chapel when Bill Wilson was released from town hospital the last time. And then Charles Clapp Jr. got sober just about the same time. He got sober just a few months after Bill, and he wrote a book called The Big Bender that's really a lot of fun. What it is that Sam had was this talent for getting people to share. And again, what he was trying to do was get them to clear away the wreckage of their past. And this is the way he described it. We can hardly resent painting our sins in bright colors and making ourselves heroes and heroines of the great spiritual conflicts we have fought. Although we may have succumbed to sin in the fight, pride is subtle as a serpent and it can enter even our accusations against ourselves, giving us, although we may not acknowledge it, a perverse enjoyment of our confession. In the book, What is the Oxford Group?, they describe sharing. They said, sharing does not mean divulging indiscretions that involve another person by name. It means confessing our part in sinning. Placing the blame on others and making excuses for our weakness is not sharing. It is merely negative, selfish talk. Wouldn't that be a nice sign in the Milano Club?
Yeah.
Again, these are the things that this, why is it that these guys are attracted to this guy? And this is what Shoemaker said, what he learned from quiet time when he was looking at himself. He said, I discovered four things which needed putting right in my life. One, there was a person who'd wronged me who I would not forgive. Two, there was restitution that I would not make. Three, there was a doubtful pleasure which I would not give up. That's before the internet. Four, there was a sin in the long past that I would not confess. When these were straightened out, I not only came into new power and release, but for the first time, I began to get daily guidance, which I knew could be relied and acted upon. That I knew could be relied and acted upon. Oh, yeah. This is from his book, Twice Born Ministers. But this is a professional God person talking about his problem. That's why these guys could listen to him. Yeah. These are on the handout. Now again, when it comes to quiet time, this is what Buckman said about his own life. Shoemaker said about his own life. He said that there's need for rededication day by day, hour by hour, by which progressively in every quiet time the contaminations of sin and self-will are sloughed off. So they have a way of collecting. And we are kept in fresh touch with the living spirit of God. This is a guy who's got problems like me. And I believe that it was these expressions that allowed our forefathers to listen to him. And by reading his steps, and what happens is that you see that the language and the steps and the things that we practice were developed by these spiritual pioneers. Okay. This is a list of the major players again. Bill Wilson said in a wonderful talk that he gave that if you were looking for the start of Alcoholics Anonymous, we could start 2,000 years ago with the birth of Christ. Or, he said, there are many of our friends who would even push it back further than that. But for my discussion, which is from the Oxford Group, that Frank Buckman is the person who carried a message of depth and weight and a practical application of spiritual principles to mental and physical and psychological problems, to Sam Shoemaker, who shared these with Roland Hazard and James Newton. Roland Hazard was a childhood friend of Wilson. James Newton was an Oxford Group member that carried the message to Russell Firestone about turning his life to Christ. Shep Cornell was one of the men who was sober who helped Hazard rescue Ebby, and we'll talk about that later about the when we do the long form of the Akron Miracle. We'll talk about Shep's relationship with Ebby. B.C. Kitchen was sober and in the Oxford group at Calvary Chapel when Bill came in, as well as Abby and Roland. The Reverend Walter Tunks, who we'll see in a couple other places, he was the Firestone family rector. They belonged to the Episcopal Church there in Akron, and he was the biggest Oxford group supporter. He was the guy that welcomed Buckman and the Oxford group team on behalf of the city when they made their visit in 1933. T. Henry Williams and his wife Clarice. T. Henry was the developer of a tire mold that all the different tire companies in Akron used, and he was a person who made his home available for the West Hills Oxford group meetings. And those members were Henrietta Cyberling, Robert Holbrook Smith, Ann Smith. And then, of course, I've got up there our friend William D. Silkworth, who was the physician at Towns Hospital, and of course, Bill Wilson. That's it. Now, the last thing that I'd like to do is I'd like to read you a piece from of Sam Shoemaker's. He wrote poetry. It was one of the things that he liked to do. And this is an apologia for his life, and it's called I Stand by the Door. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important thing in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there, when so many are still outside, and they, so much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall, where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men, with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to that man's own touch. Men die outside that door as starving beggars die, on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for the want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. This is the man that when a member of the Oxford group came, Bill Wilson, who was being accused of not being maximum, of not being involved enough in going out to change American business because he had an obsession with helping drunks sober up, against the group conscience of all of his friends and his mentor, said, Bill, you're right. Follow it. Because he believed that Bill would be able to put people's hands on the door. Thank you. I will be happy to entertain questions, but please make them simple enough that I can repeat them into the microphone because we're being recorded. I don't, but our email address is here, and we'll be happy to send it to you. A lot of this stuff's out of print. The stuff that is in print, which I would really recommend to you, is first and foremost, the thing that's fired me up, well, the thing that originally fired me up the most was I Was a Pagan by V.C. Kitchen. But that's not available. But a really fun read is this, this What is the Oxford Group? It's got, this is brand new from Hazelden. There's a reworking of it and kind of New Age AA parlance in the front called Practicing the Principles, but go to the back and see how much of it you really recognize. It's tremendous. The other thing that I found, and I could talk for another quite a bit on Buckman, is this book called On the Tail of the Comet. It's by Garth Lean, and the best place to get it actually is Amazon. It's not available much in bookstores. It's put out by Moral Rearmament. And just another little aside about Buckman. In 1957, Moral Rearmament teams went to Little Rock, and they showed a film that they'd put together in Africa to help with African tribal problems to the National Guard, to Governor Favis, to the NAACP people, and all these different groups kind of one at a time. And what it did is it changed the dynamic of the city. In fact, one person described it as the single most important thing that had happened on the 100th anniversary of the Civil War. So, anyway, but it all kinds of just amazing things to hear about this man and then the work that he did. What happened to the Oxford Group? The Oxford Group in 1938. Now, this is really a fun thing. The Oxford Group described themselves, their mission, as to solve personal, national, and international problems by bringing men and women everywhere back to Christian principles. In 1938, as the Second World War is starting to mount, they, as a group, started really to focus on politicians and countries and organizations and churches. What they were trying to do was work through the hierarchical system to try and effect change. And they became Moral Rearmament. In 1939, there was a split between Shoemaker and Buckman over this, because he felt that they were no longer working in personal religious work, and they were too focused on international, and that wasn't something that as a rector or as a churchman that he felt was part of his mission. The question is, what is it that Buckman said about the Nazis that infuriated so many people? Frank is on a liner, as that's where you travel, and he's coming back from England, or he's going to England, and this guy says to him, he's having a conversation with a guy, it's not on the record, he's a press guy, and he says that he does not believe that any person could not be changed. What he was trying to do was, he was trying to get Himmler and Hitler and all of the superstructure of the German government to work the steps.
Oh boy.
And what happened is, he said in an offhanded comment, he said, I thank God for Adolf Hitler because his change would affect so many others. And what happened was, the soundbite comes out, Buckman says, thank God for Hitler. And thank you for that question, because it allows me to read another little fun thing about Moral Rearmament. Now, this is a guy who was vilified by everybody. And one of the things was that his workers, they tried to keep them out of being drafted in the Second World War because they're busy working in factories. They're working with management and labor teams. They're trying to help with the war movement as far as production and things go. They were a real rah-rah thing about, you know, people working together. And there was a investigation by the Selective Service Administration. And it noted that Moral Rearmament, the evolutionary name of the Oxford Group, right, drew the fire equally of Nazis and communists, of the extreme right and extreme left in politics, of aggressive atheists and narrow ecclesiastics. It had been charged by radicals with being militaristic and by warmongers with being pacifistic. Certain elements in labor denounced it as anti-union, certain elements in management as pro-union. In Britain, the report went on, NRA was accused of being a brilliantly clever front for fascism. In Germany and Japan, of being a super intelligent arm of the British and American Secret Service. One day, a press report would announce that MRA was defunct, and the next day, that it numbered nearly the entire membership of the British cabinet at the time of Munich and was responsible for engineering Hitler's attack upon Russia. Nothing, concludes the analysis, but a potentially vast moral and spiritual reformation of global proportions could possibly be honored by antagonisms so venomous and contradictory in character and so worldwide in scope. Well, the question is, what happened to Ebi? That's really not what the purpose of this talk's about, but as I understand it, we have to remember that these people that got sober in the Oxford group did not have sobriety dates like we know them. And people drank. And when people drink, bad stuff happens. And he had a hard time in staying sober. And whether he was pushed out of AA or whatever, anything that I've ever read or seen, and especially when you read the stuff about, there's a wonderful book by Nell Wing called Privilege to Have Been There. And she talks about how heartbreaking it was for Bill when Ebi'd show up. And he always would give him money. They're always trying to do whatever he could because he believed that Ebi saved his life. That's what I know about it. You know, he later got sober, and I believe he died in Texas. He died sober.
He's written about by Lois.
Okay. And he's written about by Lois, and Lois remembers. And there's also a new biography that's come out, and I haven't read it yet, about it's called Ebi T. And I think Mel B. In fact, I'm sure Mel B. wrote it. So it's available probably through Hazelden. Yes, Frank.
I'm Frank B.
The next talk tomorrow will be on the. We'll tell the long story form of what I call the Akron Miracle, and we'll start at 1907, and we'll go all the way through. And Dr. Jung will be. But he wasn't an Oxford group member, so that's why we didn't talk about him today. Yes, sir. The question was Oxford University's not wanting them to use the name Oxford Group, the reason that they changed the name, that was a an ongoing problem always. It was more something that they were called than something that they professed to be themselves, and then later it was just that people knew them as that. But really, when they changed to moral rearmament, it was actually in response to Buckman's working with a socialist leader, who the way that he described it is that as all these nations are arming, that the only thing that's going to save the world from Armageddon is moral rearmament, and these four steps will allow us to do that. The question is, did Bill maintain his relationship with moral rearmament as years went by? No. In fact, one of the things that's real interesting, like we all know about what happened in Akron, where Clarence said, "We're going to have a meeting in Cleveland, and it's for alcoholics only, no Oxford Group members." And there were some fist fights that broke out among those kind and tolerant Christians. And that's some serious stuff. The OG members actually drove up and tried to crash the meeting in Cleveland. It was really fun. So we know about that. But really what happened in New York was that Bill was pushed out of the group because he wouldn't follow the guidance of the group regarding what it should be. There's stuff that we've got about Garrett Steely and Buckman sitting down and working personally with Bill and Lois about, you got to get off this alcoholic stuff. We've got drunken nations to take care of. We don't have to worry about drunken people. One of the things that's said about why it was that Buckman wasn't that interested was that he'd been working with drunks all of his ministry. And he found them rather easy to to convert compared to normal people. And he thought that it was much more. Now, he kept saying to Bill, you were a millionaire. You know, you were somebody. You're somebody. You know, your testimony, your conversion experience could help us with American business. Why are you worried about these drones? What Byron was commenting on was is that you know that drunks had problems with accepting Jesus, and the Oxford Group was a Christian movement, and one of the interesting things, at least from the way that I was exposed to it, is that they really were all that interested in drunks. I mean, they were, but it really didn't matter when their focus was the world and lots of different people, and we just weren't that large of a group for them to be concerned or try to work their thing from. But yeah, Bill, when he wrote the steps, made sure that everybody could come in, and one of the great things that Sam Shoemaker talked about in his piece on the 12 steps, as I understand them, was how it was that Bill wrote the steps so that everyone could come in and everybody could help. Yeah, you can become a member today if you wish. the question is moral rearmament still in existence today? It is. They have an office in Washington, and they have one in London, and they may have one in Canada also. But yes, they still are out and about, and they still are working. When you read on the Tale of a Comet or any of the other commentaries about the group, you know, they still are functioning, basically trying to do the same thing, which is to get people to use spiritual principles not only in their personal life but in their political life. The question is, did Sam Shoemaker go back to China, and was he fluent in Chinese? I don't know if he was fluent in Chinese or not. He probably had some rudimentary knowledge of it, just because in order to go and work as a missionary, you need to do that. After 1918, I'm not sure, I can't tell you for sure, but during that seven-year period, they went around the world a few times. And I'm sure that they probably, I know Buckman went back a couple of times after that. Anything else? Thank you so very much. We've got...